today. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the greatest magazine in the universe. The oldie, and it's so kind of you to come today, and it's wonderful to see you back after the, while the pandemic hopefully is in decline. The sharper-eyed among you will notice that I am not Barry Cryer, and I'm so extremely sorry to all the many fans of the great Barry. He's very, very sorry. He asked me to send my apologies to all of you because he's been taken ill. Nothing drastic, but he will normally, he so loves performing, and he's very, very sad not to be here. And his and my apologies to you. This is the second in our series of oldie gang shows in this wonderful room. And our first speaker is a biographer and literary agent, Andrew Lowney, author of biographies of John Buchan and Guy Burgess. His latest book, which we'll talk about today, is The Traitor King, looking at the behavior of the Duke of Windsor, particularly during the war. For his book on the recent book on the Mountbattens, Andrew has spent £250,000 on legal efforts to open up the archive. So you really have to buy his book after this talk. And all the books will be available for signing after the three talks. I'm very delighted to introduce Andrew Lowney.
Harry, many thanks. Yes, my children will be very pleased if you could go and help the family funds there. It is a huge scandal, the fact that these diaries and letters have been closed, having been bought with public funds. The good news is that 99% of them have now been released after a four-year campaign. The bad news is the lawyers are still charging the bills. Anyway, I'm talking about the Traitor King, and I think what struck me when I decided on this subject was, though there have been lots and lots of books on the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, there hasn't actually been a book which looked at the period after the abdication. And that was a period of 50 years. And in many ways, I think by looking at that period, we can actually shine fresh light on the abdication. My own theory, having looked at it, is that actually we were jolly lucky not to have Edward VIII as a king. And I think people at the time realized that beforehand. I mean, even his private secretary was hoping he would kill himself steeplechasing. But fortunately, we had Wallis Simpson came along, and she was, the device in which they got rid of him. And so the other great, I think, myth is that this was a great love affair between two of them. They walked off into the sunset. The fact was that he had threatened to commit suicide if she didn't marry him. She was chained to this, in effect, boy who had never really grown up, who was emotionally dependent on her. She began to resent this relationship. In fact, at one point, I saw a letter from Rebecca West the other day. They thought of splitting up. And she was, as a result, went off and had various affairs, as did he. But she really began to resent him. And the more that she was awful to him, the more he liked it, which is a particular trait of the British aristocracy. That is the other part of it. But the central part of the book is, and I've very deliberately called the book Traitor King without a question mark, was the way that he got involved with the Nazis. Now, this is not a new story, but pretty much every historian up till now has just said he was an innocent dupe, he was caught up in the machinations of the Nazis, he didn't know about it, he was foolish and naive, but that's it. But it's very clear when you look at the archives, and I have to say, those archives in Britain are not open, they've all been heavily weeded, but they are available in the Bahamas. There's a mirror set of files there they didn't know about until now. There's files in Germany and France and elsewhere. And my best place was the place I least expected to find anything, and that was the Royal Archives, which have just been reopened. I think everyone assumed that everything went to the Royal Archives would never be seen by anyone. It's a bit like a restaurant where there's no menu. You just get given various documents they want you to see. But actually, there's been a change of stance there, and there's all the stuff, including the monitoring by George VI of what his brother was up to all the way through. But my argument, and I think I've made it with lots and lots of primary research, is that the Duke was prepared to betray this country. He wanted to big himself up in the eyes of Wallace. He was very pro-German. He was 14th, 16th German. He spoke fluent German. He was much more sympathetic to the sort of German way of life. He believed in the Führerprinzip. In fact, he believed that Hitler was a good man, even in the 1960s. And So I traced this relationship of the traitor king right through to the way that he interfered in politics even when he was king in 1936, to his visit to Nazi Germany in 1937, his entreaties to Hitler at the beginning of the war, the crucial moment, Operation Willy, in the summer of 1940, when the Germans basically went to him saying that we are about to invade Britain, we think we're going to win the war, would you like to come back and take over from your brother? And he said, yes, please. It's fascinating. We have the chapter and verse of this for one simple reason. Partly, this stuff in the Royal Archives and the Churchill papers, but all the telegrams between Berlin, Ribbentrop, and the ambassadors in Spain and Portugal, which were supposed to be destroyed at the end of the war, were not destroyed. They were buried in a forest in Germany and found by the Americans. And there was a huge fight at the end of the war to suppress all this correspondence showing his treachery. People like Bevan and Attlee and Churchill lobbied the Americans very hard. And there was a fight, a fight about academic freedom. The American historians insisted that this correspondence had to be published and made available. And it eventually was. They delayed it till 1954. But this stuff came out. And this lays out, as I say, in chapter and verse, all the correspondence, the fact the Duke was going to the German embassy, he was in touch with them, and that even when he left, because when Churchill realized what was going on, he offered him the governorship of the Bahamas, having first threatened to court-martial him. He was sent off to the Bahamas, but even from the Bahamas, he was sending messages back in code to say that when the moment comes, I'm prepared to come back and take my place. The story of the traitor king finishes really in 1945 at the end, well, 1941 really, when the Americans come into the war. There's a section of the book which deals with his time in the Bahamas. This is the point where Wallis comes into her own. She does a lot of good works for the local Red Cross and for welfare for local black families. But he's bored. He just basically goes and gets drunk, goes to strip shows, plays golf. I mean, it doesn't bring back some sort of personal parallels now. I mean, there's a wonderful story with a man called Patrick Catlin, who was a pilot officer who actually met him. The Duke didn't even bother walking between the halls, he just drove between them. And he has this rather poignant story of the Duke taking him into one of the townships and the boys coming out and parading for him with sticks. And that's the way he sort of got his kicks, that he had sort of still had some influence or some power. We cover in the book the whole scandalous story of the murder of Harry Oakes and the involvement of the Duke in that, which was part of basically back currency dealings that he was operating in. And then it's the rather sad period of after the war, known as the Windsor problem, in the way we now have the Andrew problem, of what to do with the Duke. What could he do after the war? And no one really wanted to give him a job. He was seen to be highly indiscreet, not someone particularly dedicated to his work, and he was basically told that he must stay in exile. And one of the reasons for the bitterness in the royal family was not so much the abdication, as we've been led to believe, but the fact that he had been so treacherous. And we know that the royal family knew about this because we have it all in these documents in the Royal Archives. George VI was actually briefed about it as he stepped off the balcony in May 1945 after the VE Day celebrations. And so we have this extraordinary period of where they move among Cafe Society, spending half the year in the States, sponging off people in Long Island and Newport and Palm Beach, half the year at their property in Paris or their country house just outside Paris. They got rid of their summer house in the south of France, a modest little thing now owned by Roman Abramovich. It is a weird, weird relationship and an extraordinary thing where all their focus is really on entertaining and being entertained. There was nothing else. He had some investments, which he liked doing. He liked a bit of gardening. They had their pugs, which were substitute children, where they fed them the best steak and silver bowls. But otherwise, it was a pretty empty life. They had no inner life. They had no cultural interests. When Churchill gave the Duke of Windsor a copy of one of his books, Windsor said, "Thank you very much. I'll put it in the shelf with the others." And he was reputed to have said after one concert, "I love that music. Who's it by? Mozart, sir. Has he written anything else?" So this is sort of level a person one's dealing with. So the story covers that rather empty period after the war, and takes us through, and again right through to his death in 1972. The myths will have us that he died in the arms of Wallace. The reality is that he died in the arms of a temporary night nurse called Julie Chattard. Wallace, who had a bedroom two doors away from him, and he'd been calling out for Wallace for 2 weeks before he died, never once visited him in that two-week period. So much for the love affair. And then, of course, we end with the rather sad period at the end, where she retreats, or basically comes under the hold of a woman called Maitre Bloom, a lawyer who begins to sell off a lot of their possessions in order to pay health bills. The Duchess becomes just a sort of vegetable, living in one room, drinking vodka out of a silver tankard. All her friends are kept away, and it's there that she dies in 1986. The royal family are often blamed for cutting them loose. In fact, looking at the documents, they were pretty good to them. Poor old Bertie had never wanted the job, resented it, was annoyed with his brother for being so petulant, discovered when they tried to do the financial settlement, when the Duke abdicated, that he hadn't been honest about the amount of money he'd saved from the Duchy of Cornwall funds, and was basically trying to screw his brother. And money really was at the center of a lot of his problems. He wanted to live, again, certain parallels, in a way which was beyond him. And he did that by sponging off people or by trying to make money. Now, there's certain things that struck me when I did this book, which was perhaps one of the factors. Here was, in America, a very charismatic and popular prince who was taken away by an American divorcee, who was taken away from friends and family. Brothers fell out. The wives didn't get on. There were debates about security and finances. A lot of it was blamed on bad parenting. There was an attempt to curate the story, to sue anyone who didn't agree with them, to make money out of writing books or giving TV or radio interviews, to endorse everything from linen to cutlery. I don't know, it just reminded me of someone. So we have, in some ways, the trope of the royal family is between public duty and private pleasure, and that's continued all the way through. And there are always these rogue royals. They always make the most fantastic subjects because they are so flawed. There is a strong sense of self-entitlement about them. But I do think that it is, again, a very sad story. That he really found no role for himself after 1936, and that something couldn't be done. The royal family did make attempts to sort of come together. They were particularly concerned about a lot of the diaries, letters, and the garter robes, and the abdication desk, and things like that, getting into the wrong hands. And so when he died, Mountbatten, who was Mr. Fixit of the royal family, and the Duke of Edinburgh, were basically put either side of Wallace at the funeral lunch to persuade her to send the things back to the Royal Archives, which she did. The only way that we've actually had access to some of this material is some of it was kept back. She gave it to gardeners and people like that because she had no one else to give it to. And that stuff was eventually sold at auction and has become publicly available. So I think I've done my 15 minutes, Harry, as the warm-up act, for rather more distinguished people. But thank you very much. It is a fascinating story. And certainly opened my eyes to one of the great myths that actually there was a lot more to it than met the eye.
Thanks so much, Andrew, for an absolutely wonderful talk. And all you readers are much more high-minded than me. They wouldn't want to spend their lives getting drunk, playing golf and going to strip shows, but it sounds pretty good to me. But anyway, I think you might have been referring to Prince Harry at the end of your talk, and we're going to move the clock back, as the oldie loves to do, 500 years to the Tudor period, and one of our greatest historians, David Starkey. On the Mole Maze, he was dubbed the rudest man in Britain, but as I've often found with people who in the public eye seemed to be rude on TV, actually the model of politeness and charm in the flesh. He's presented over a dozen TV series. He's also the only living human to bounce back from being temporarily and wrongly cancelled, so we're very keen to welcome him back today. He's here to talk about Henry VIII, the first Brexiteer, David Starkey.
Harry, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to get a bit of surfeit of monarchy. I was going to talk, indeed, on Henry VIII and Brexit, but events have overtaken me, because we're witnessing the crisis of another monarchy, only a few yards from where we are now. My first talk was going to be about how Henry VIII, we've been listening to the pointless bits of monarchy. The House of Windsor is a kind of eructation at the end of British royal history, right? No more significant than that. Let's go back to the days when the king is the centre. What the king does, what he thinks, whom he loves, whom he hates, actually shapes our lives. There is one monarch who stands at the centre of English history, that is Henry VIII. He is the axis. Charles Dickens has the wonderful phrase about Henry VIII. He's a spot of blood and grease. They're both well-lubricating substances. And Henry is the axis on which English history turns between the Norman conquest and now. Everything is different. If I'd given you my first talk, Henry VIII completely reorientates foreign policy. That's what I mean when I say Henry VIII is the first Brexiteer. We would not have had the second Brexit without Henry VIII. Before Henry VIII, we are part of Europe. Mostly we're part of a cross-channel empire. The channel is not a barrier, it is a means of communication. That is what it is. Remember, we have some of the best natural harbours in the world. Every change of dynasty in the Middle Ages, including the Tudors, is the result of a foreign invasion. Henry VII is put on the throne by the French. The man who makes England different, separate, who turns the Channel into the biggest, the widest strip of water in the world, because it's true, France and England are the mirror images of a perfect civilization. We're completely opposite. Even the notion of the public interest changes the moment you cross the Channel. That is Henry VIII. He makes Rome the daughter of Babylon, the Pope, the Antichrist. In other words, he's direct ancestor of Nigel Farage. I'm being deadly serious. Deadly, deadly serious. My first school trip was to Rome when I was a 13-year-old boy. My mother was a northern working-class Puritan. She couldn't begin to say how appalled she was at the thought I was a sort of innocent, I suppose I was in those days, well, not very, schoolboy being sent off to Rome. And I can still remember her saying to me, "Now remember to wash your hands very well. They have funny toilet habits, you know." And this is the model of our sense of difference. And it's Henry. Henry first turns England to an island. He makes England defensible. He constructs literally a chain of fortifications from Newcastle on Tyne and Hull. He invents Hull, God help us, and indeed Newcastle, the whole of the way round to Milford Haven. He then constructs the second wall of the Royal Navy, and finally he constructs the ideology. If you think of Shakespeare's great speeches, this land of England, this jewel set in a silver sea and whatever, it's lifted directly from Henry VIII's propaganda. So that's the talk I would have given. Let's now shift to what it's called the, I was good at Précy, you know, it's very, very important. Let's shift now, and I didn't have any lunch. Let's now shift to the important subject, which is Henry, the inventor of our modern political system. Why do we talk about government as being Whitehall? Why do we talk of Parliament as being Westminster? These are places, they are palaces. And it is Henry VIII who invents this doubleness, this diarchy, on which the whole of our subsequent system of government is based. Up to the reign of Henry VIII, there is only a single palace in England, and that is the Palace of Westminster, which is on the site of the present palace, and indeed the Great Hall still survives, as does St. Stephen's Cloister and the crypt of St. Stephen's Chapel, which was the English Sainte Chapelle. It was equally beautiful and lovely, but unfortunately destroyed by Henry VIII and Edward VI Reformation. In the Palace of Westminster, the king lived when politics happened. Remember, politics in the Middle Ages is just like politics now. It basically happens between November and June. It's cyclical. It's an occasion. Everybody goes away for the summer. And in that period, from the 1st of November to the end of June, the king lives in the Palace of Westminster at one end, the southern end of the palace. At the northern end of the palace, Parliament sits. The Privy Council meets, or rather the Star Chamber meets in Star Chamber, the Exchequer is there, the law courts are there, everything else is there. So you've got both, as it were, our idea of government and the personal residence of the sovereign. Because remember, how we've got ourselves so badly mixed up about Downing Street and the parties, are they work or are they pleasure, is that in real government there is no distinction. There is absolutely no distinction. And remember, the whole idea of a professional place that you go to work in is a late 19th century invention. Look in Dickens, everybody works at home. Or everywhere you are, it's Mr. So-and-so's or Miss So-and-so's. It's within the household and the direct access of the household. Exactly the same in the medieval palace. What happens at the beginning of Henry VIII's reign is that the private bit of the Palace of Westminster is burnt out. Remember, we always talk about the building of palaces. One of the most important things is the destruction of palaces. Destruction is at least as important in history as building. And the private Palace of Westminster burns out at the beginning of Henry VIII's reign and is never, ever rebuilt. And no king ever lives there again, despite the fact that when it's rebuilt at vast expense in the Victorian period, Prince Albert makes absolutely sure it's smothered in royal symbols, because you're determined to keep the idea of a parliamentary monarchy, with a monarch being present for the state opening of Parliament, the Royal Gallery, and everything else. What does Henry do? Well, to begin with, he's the playboy king, so it's perfectly fine for him mainly to live at Greenwich, and when he needs to come to London, he commutes by boat. And can I tell you, it is much easier and faster to commute in Tudor London than now. It took me 55 minutes from Islington because of the insanity of TfL, which we're all familiar with. It took Henry VIII, if he waited for the turning of the tide, 30 minutes to get from Greenwich to Westminster, because you can, the tide is, you know, if the tide is flowing back, if you're on the ebb tide and it's flowing up, you flow up rapidly, you go rapidly, you go on the London Bridge fine, and you're there. So he commutes. Then, of course, the great moment, one of the great moments of Henry's reign, the fall of Cardinal Wolsey. How had he survived? Well, he had run government from the town palace of the Archbishops of York, which is exactly where, roughly where Downing Street is. It's, most of it is now actually under the Ministry of Defence. And he reconstructs this into a major town palace. There's still what's called King Street, which goes on the line roughly of Whitehall. So Wolsey constructs this. And then there is one of those moments that we can all rejoice in. Wolsey falls. There's a triumph over his body, and the king and his new floozy, I call her Annie Boleyn, otherwise known as Carrie Antoinette. The new highly political floozy goes in and they seize the palace. And Henry rebuilds it into this gigantic Palace of Whitehall, which is the biggest palace in Europe, and its principal room stretches from the site of the Ministry of Defence and the Thames the whole of the way across to St James's Park. And it is the St James's Park side, where there is the Horse Guards, where there is the Treasury and whatever, that's the Royal Playpen. It's where you have the tilt yard is where Horse Guards parade is. The Treasury is built directly on top of the cockpit, which seems very appropriate, and the Privy Council office on top of the tennis play. And they're all still there. And you have this huge gallery connecting them. So Henry VIII lives there. So there are two palaces. What goes on in the old palace? What goes on in the new? In the old palace, all the formal instruments of government, Parliament, the Exchequer, the Star Chamber, the Court of Chancery, the Court of King's Bench, the Court of of Common Pleas, all continue to meet. They all use, as they still do, because many of them still survive, they use the Royal Coat of Arms. But the King never attends them. He never goes there. This is the idea of kingship as our modern notion of constitutional monarchy. It's the symbol of the continuity of authority. What goes on in the new Palace of Whitehall is the real king with his real personal will and the new instruments of government that Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell create for this. This is where the Privy Council meets, directly in a room next to the king. His own bedchamber. His secretary is in a room directly next to the king's study. We know this because his clerks can't get in at night because they'll disturb the king. He's sleeping next door. So in the new palace, you create the new instruments of an aggressive personal assertion of monarchy. And the subsequent history of England is a clash, not between monarchist and republican, not even in the Civil War. There are hardly any republicans in the English Civil War. They cut Charles's head off by mistake, by default. There's nobody actually wants to do it, not even Cromwell wants to do it. It's a clash between two different views of monarchy. The monarchy, the actual will of the person of the king, and on the other, the monarch as a symbol of the continuity of national authority, tradition, and whatever. And that struggle, of course, exacerbated by religion, the fact that the king has made that Henry VIII has made the king at the head of the church, means that religion becomes the arena over which that's fought. The struggle is not solved until 1688-89. You know, we English, we're very slow-witted. We're one of the slowest people, actually, to do anything politically. But when we do it, we tend to do it rather radically. We are the first people, actually, to cut a king's head off publicly. That's the French take another century and a half. They're ebullient but shallow, as we all know. And as I always say, by definition, all bad ideas are French, but that's an entirely different matter. But what the English do in 1689 is turn the world upside down. Up to that point, the convention had been that the religion of the people should be the religion of the king. We think, gosh, this is jolly inconvenient. We've had to change religion every time we've changed monarch, and it gets a bit, gets a bit exhausting. Why don't we do something else? That the religion of the king will be the religion of his people. That is what the Glorious Revolution is about. The struggle then continues because we still can't make up our mind what religion there should be. And finally, it's settled at the beginning of the 18th century with Queen Anne and the succession of the Hanoverian House. But the relationship between the two sorts of monarchy is only settled by one of the villain figures of English history, the wicked Sir Robert Walpole, the first Prime Minister. And if you think Boris is drunk, think of Walpole. If you think Boris is corrupt, think of Walpole. If you think Boris has indecent affairs, think of Walpole and be awestruck at just how bad Boris is at being bad. But there we are. And I'm being very serious underneath the flippancy. What Walpole does is solve and square the circle of English history. He creates a second monarchy. The position of Prime Minister is a second monarch. What you'd, and really the first monarch. What you do is, First of all, the position of Prime Minister has got a double face. It's Janus-faced. On the one hand, it is how Parliament broadly controls the monarchy, the real monarchy, over policy. But on the other hand, it deploys the... It's why premiers are always corrupt. It's why we still have a House of Lords and an honours system and everything else. You deploy the resources of royal patronage to control Parliament. Because remember, although the Supreme Court clearly understood nothing of English history, parliaments have to be managed. Otherwise, they're just a talking shop. This is why ours is one of the very few parliaments that survived, and virtually no European country has been able to run a parliamentary system, because it has to be managed. Otherwise, it's just a lot of 600 loudmouthed people, as you were saying, who don't know when to stop and just, you know, keep on, no sense of brevity, and keep on talking. We discover this extraordinary double office. It also coincides with something else. I said destruction. The Palace of Whitehall had just burnt down. It burns down in 1698, and it too is never rebuilt. The monarchy never goes back there. It squats first at St. James's and then in little places like Buckingham Palace and all the rest of it. It squats, basically. What goes on in Whitehall? You give the Prime Minister his own town palace. We think of Downing Street as that rather modest 18th century house. Anybody who's been there knows that is literally only a facade. An opening behind it is this huge, elegant, late 17th century structure of something like 55 rooms that backs onto horse guards. It's a town palace. It's given to Walpole by George II, and surrounding it, all the new instruments of the great age of England, which is the 18th century, the Admiralty, the horse guards, where the armies are administered, and the treasury, all have their own offices. In other words, the two monarchs do two different things. The monarch whose numbers we record, whose final burp, or one of final burps, as I described, was what Andrew was talking about, is merely the equivalent of the Japanese Mikado. He is merely a symbolic monarch. The real monarch, the wielder of power, the wielder of patronage, the determiner of policy, is just like the Japanese shogun in Tokyo, he is the Prime Minister. And unless we understand that, unless we understand Downing Street is a palace where access to the monarch, access to the Prime Minister is absolutely everything, unless we understand, of course, that the consort wields exactly the power that we would expect in, whether it's public or not. Carrie has just been unusual in that she's been stupid enough to flaunt it. Exactly as Anne Boleyn did. One can only hope that there's a certain continuity of experience, you know. I imagine Boris Johnson is probably hoping for some saviour even as I speak. Unless we understand that, we understand nothing. And always the figure, the axis, the determinant that even now exercises power over us. I remember waking up after the Brexit vote had been announced. I'd gone to bed convinced that the England of Henry VIII was dead. We were going to vote to remain in the European Union. And then the English, very much the English people, not the Scots by any means, the English people decided they still wanted a real king even 500 years after he was dead on the throne. And they voted to keep Henry's Brexit and, by definition, I suppose, to keep Henry's ghost still ruling over us as the real monarch on the ghost site of his dead palace, still there, still, I suppose, faintly smiling at our folly. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David, for that absolutely dazzling speech, particularly gripping to hear a geographical view of history, and very exciting that it's all taking just up the road, 5 minutes up the road there. And if you heard a sigh of relief about halfway through David's brilliant talk, it was Boris Johnson in Downing Street writing down David's words, saying that Downing Street is always a place of work and never a private place where you can have a party. And our last speaker is one of our most distinguished actresses, Dame Eileen Atkins. Extraordinarily enough, last year was the 80th anniversary of her first stepping on the stage as Baby Eileen. She has dominated the stage and the screen ever since. You may have read her interview in the Daily Telegraph at the weekend, full of wisdom, including the best way to save money is don't get married. And astonishingly, as well as being one of our greatest actresses, she also co-wrote Upstairs, Downstairs with Jean Marsh, and she revealed that she only got 40 quid an episode. So another reason why you must buy her book afterwards. She'll be talking to Valerie Grove, our distinguished radio columnist at the Oldie, ever since our first issue, which is almost exactly 30 years ago. We'll be celebrating the 30th anniversary in the next issue. We must also thank Valerie's sister-in-law, Mary Kenny, who is here, another great columnist for the Oldie, and it's thanks to her membership of this wonderful club that we're able to hold it here today. So, Dame Eileen Atkins and Valerie Grove.
Can you hear me now?
Is it on now? Is that now? Better? Yes. Is it on? Yes. It is on. Are we on?
Three flights of steps. Huge step up here, which both our recent brilliant speakers have just leapt up like young goats.
I staggered.
I didn't notice. And we're going to be so dull now.
No, certainly not, Eileen. Thank you. Baby Eileen, if I may call you that.
She's bringing me to order.
Eileen is one of the wittiest and funniest
people
ever.
Oh, don't say that.
I, as the radio critic, I will say that the reading of this wonderful book, can we wave it in the air, which you really must buy. Please wave it in the air. Thank you.
Well, it's over there.
I left mine in the big bag.
Your picture in the air. This is me. This is me. It's just a little book about me. That's all it is.
The book was read beautifully, and it was abbreviated, of course, savagely as they always are. But Eileen read it herself, which is very rare actually on Books of the Week on Radio 4. But you did it beautifully.
I should hope so. I've been doing it for years.
And it was lovely. And I did go. It was going to be Giles Brandreth here today with Dame Eileen, and they've done their double act quite a bit. I saw that the Duke of York's theatre in November, Giles interlocuting Dame Eileen, and he not only called her Baby Eileen, he got her to do the tap dance she did when she was 7, only 8 years ago. I'm not going to ask you to do it.
No.
I know that you, she did the tap dance, but with no taps. But I thought you might sing a little song.
What?
No, when she was the soubrette in the working men's clubs of Tottenham and Edmonton and North London as a child, she used to do a little song, and she had to make it really sexy. What was the one called? I am a Frenchy girl.
I have to get out.
You can say it.
I don't even know if I remember it.
You can say it.
She sprung all this on me. I may stop totally. But it might come back. I can't do it with this because I've got actions. I'll have to really speak up.
Use mine.
I got C I. That makes Z wink. Z wink. That makes the fellows think. I got the mouse to go like this. Ooh la la, I am French and a Frenchy girl can kiss. I got the style, I got the smile that makes the old men young, la la. They hug and squeeze me like a sheep, then they kiss me on the cheek. Ooh la la, comme ci, comme ça. I guess Jeffrey Epstein would have loved me.
I'm rather proud of something. Can I just say my Epstein pride?
Mm.
I was told on Boxing Day that I was in Jeffrey Epstein's notebook. Why? And I've been longing to know why. And last night I watched a not very good TV programme about Ghislaine Maxwell. And it turned out that if you're not in the book, you are nobody. Because it is just famous people.
Yes.
So I'm thrilled because Maggie Smith and Judy Dench aren't in there.
I urge you to read this book, not only because it tells you all about that period of her life, it tells you so much more about the acting life. And you wrote this book in lockdown. You must have had a wonderful time.
I loved lockdown. I'm sorry if any of you had a bad time. But I've been asked to write about, because I did have a slightly weird childhood, being this horrible baby Eileen. And I've been asked to write it for 11 years. And then when lockdown came, I thought, I might as well think about that. And Lenny Goodings. And so I got down to it. It's wonderful. I did my own hours, which are not to get up until 10 o'clock and work from sort of 12 till 2 and then 4 till 6. And I had a lovely time.
It's a wonderful book. And I love the fact that level pegging in the bestseller lists and the recommendations for the books of the year were Eileen and Miriam Margolyes, who are great friends and both take great pleasure in one another's success. No?
Yeah, absolutely. She is a very good friend of mine. But when I'm with her, she's not allowed to talk about farting. End of story. or any of that. And we don't. She's terrific. Fun.
Well, that is very odd, Eileen, because when you were 80 or 70 or something, it was a big birthday, I did an interview with you for the Oldie, and it was great fun. But something you said, actually, I think it got into a book of theatrical quotations, because Eileen said, do you remember what you said?
No idea what I said.
What? You said, I always said I would, am I going to give up? Give up when
I've remembered.
When I farted on stage.
Yes.
And I'm long past that now, she said, and the young ones do it all the time, and nobody seems to mind.
That's true. That is true. I was once in a theatre in the Haymarket when Rex Harrison was doing that Barry play, The Admirable Crichton, and Rex let loose one. And the whole, the front 7, 8, 9 rows, we all knew, and the whole cast started laughing. And it almost got around. Yes, but I don't like Miriam when Miriam is being Miriam on the...
Yes, farting on 5 continents.
She goes on a bit about it too much.
Yes. But anyway, let's leave Miriam and her life. The point about actors' memoirs, always, is that they're full of good stories, some better than others. Eileen's is absolutely stuffed with marvellous stories. And why not tell a good a corpsing story, for instance? Corpsing is one of the great pitfalls of the profession.
I think that might be quite difficult to...
Yes.
Can I just make a remark about my childhood? Because I think it's more than half the book. And it was interesting in this way, in that I was brought up on a council estate in Tottenham, and a gypsy came to the door and told my mother I was going to be a great dancer, which is why she sent me to, which is how I started to be baby Eileen and picked up that. But my father, people say to me, where do you get the desire to act from? I sometimes think it all comes from my father, because my father was a very jolly man who sang at parties and entertained. But when the war started, I was 5, and my father was a gas meter reader, and he made himself look like Hitler. Mm-hmm. And So he grew a little tash there, and he slicked his, and he did look quite like him. And people used to say, well, somebody had said to him before, Mr. Atkins, you don't half look like Adolf. And so he'd taken it on. He was going to look like Adolf. And one day he came back home with a story, and he didn't find it funny at all. He said, I was reading a meter today up Hackney, and the meter was in a cupboard, and I'm reading it, and this woman comes up behind me. She pushes me in the cupboard. She calls the police, gets, because they were in the street in those days. He says, and she says, I've got Hitler disguised as a meter reader up here. And he never found it remotely funny. So I think he had a desire to become someone else, and that I've got from my father. I desire. And it was a very rackety childhood, because, you know, when most kids were in bed asleep, I was being hauled out and taken down the tube and stepping over the bodies down in the tube that were sleeping down there, and performing in men's clubs, which were no, there was no doubt. Well, I've only just seen all you up there. I'm so sorry I haven't nodded up that way. I thought it was a mirror.
And there are more here, I'm afraid.
Gosh.
Yes.
And so I did. I just had a very, I think, interesting childhood. That way I was half dead with tiredness all the time. And then I was picked up by a wonderful teacher, which most people who do anything from
one particular teacher who teaches you about speaking about Shakespeare.
He was just absolutely fabulous. But, you know, it's...
Yes. When you went among the most of the intake at the Guildhall, where you went to at the after being encouraged by Mr. Burton, you found yourself among girls who were born to the profession. They were the daughters and relations of other actors. And you were quite different from anybody else, as your mother had wanted you to be. You were unique in your circle.
I felt very uncomfortable there. I didn't like it, because, you know, I'd gone from a grammar school where everybody was roughly like me, a little bit posher than me, actually. Most of them were sort of just about middle class. Though my mother always thought she was middle class. She voted Conservative to show that she was middle class. I did feel very uncomfortable. I only felt comfortable. Actually, I'm going to be serious. The only thing, you want me to read something, don't you? But the only thing I'm going to read, I think, is the prologue that I wrote in this, because it's about, but it's not funny. A lot of my book is funny. And if you men think it's not for you, because mostly men don't think a book by a woman like me is for them. I have had letters of huge congratulation from Tom Stoppard, David Hare, and Richard Eyre. So men are reading it. Though a lot of them buy it for their wives. But this is serious. This is just me. And this was the first piece of paper I sent to Lenny Goodings, because I didn't know whether I could write or not. And she said, just write anything. Just write anything that comes into your head. And so this was what I wrote. I said, just a page of something. She said, yes. Just a paragraph, I said. She said, yes. And this is what I sent her. One evening in the early 1950s, when I was 19, I was walking from my shabby digs in Oxford to the theatre, where I was an ASM, which meant that I was sweeping the stage, borrowing props, begging furniture, prompting, and occasionally appearing on stage and saying a line or two if I was lucky. It was a dreary autumn evening with a thin rain soaking right through to one's soul, and the last part of the journey took me down a very affluent, architecturally admired street of houses, where most lower ground floors had been turned into kitchen diners and had their lights on, displaying the domestic scenes within. A woman cooking, laying the table for supper, often one or two children helping. And at one house I observed a man as he opened the front door and stopped to watch him as he entered the scene downstairs. The welcome, the smiles, the kissing, the laughing. And I was overwhelmed by the thought that I would never be that woman, because at this twilight hour, I would always be on my way to the theatre. Standing in the seeping rain, I was drenched with melancholy. I trudged onto the theatre and pushed through the stage door, which immediately led to the green room, stinking of cigarettes, littered with dirty mugs, and two sleeping actors sprawled on chairs. My melancholy vanished in seconds. This is my home, I thought, as I happily gathered up the mugs. This is where I belong and where I'll always want to be.
Beautiful. Quite right.
But it is funny as well.
Beautiful piece of writing. No, it is. It's wonderful. And I remember very much, well, wasn't the first time I'd met you, but the first time I went to interview you, and it was 1988, and you were doing Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own as a one-person show, and you had made it into a dramatic performance. It was a talk that Virginia had given, wasn't it, at Girton?
Yeah, she started by giving it a speech, and then she turned it into an essay. Yeah.
And then the essay was... Eileen was scintillating in that, and you had already become a star through George, the killing of Sister George, yes.
Yep.
But this was such a winning performance, and it led to Vita and Virginia, which is something you put together, wrote with Vanessa Redgrave to perform. But you were at Hampstead Theatre, and I found a boy of 17 sitting on a wall outside. Do you remember? And I went and I talked to you about this boy who was writing you a note and saying how much you had brought Virginia Woolf to life. So you see, there are cultured boys like that. And we were so pleased, you and I. He wrote you the note and he put it through the window of your dressing room window. And we both thought if only boys, more boys, would read that Virginia Woolf essay, in which she says, you know, it is perfect, it's been perfectly legal all these through the centuries for men to insist that their daughters marry whom they decide and pull her about the room. They're allowed to do that and beat her if she doesn't. And you made it also vivid.
I just want to tell you an interesting story about A Room of One's Own. I started out not thinking anybody would make her think. It was a complete trial having a go at Hampstead to see if it worked. And it did work wonderfully well. And I wanted to do it again, but I'd already contracted to do another play, so I had to put it away for a while. And then somebody in the audience, an American, had said, please come and do that in America. Not only did I have a run on Broadway with it, but I toured the whole of America for a year doing it to packed houses. I came back to England, and after a little rest and doing something else, I thought, oh, I'd like to do that. In England, I only did it for 3 weeks at Hampstead. So I went to the tour, people who'd fix up the tours, and I said, look, I'd love to do this on tour in Britain, as you know, I've done it in America. And nobody was interested because I wasn't a big enough TV star to tour, and Virginia Woolf was not admired enough in England for me to do a tour. So I tried two or three times to get somebody, but it's just an interesting insight that in America, everyone had heard of Virginia Woolf, and it's here. It's not being known in your own, loved or admired in your own. Well, of course, she is loved and admired here, but only by a very small group.
At the same time as you did Virginia, you were reading. You used to do poetry readings for Josephine Hart's Poetry Hour at the British Library. Well, and before that at Hammersmith, and you would do. There was a marvellous evening when you and Edward Fox did Eliot and Michael Goff. It was beautiful, wonderful, as did Prufrock.
Michael Goff is the best reader of...
he was wonderful, yes. But only you could do the right accent for Hurry Up, Please, It's Time.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Well, it was What About Me Teeth.
I mean, that's absolutely... I mean, it's second nature to me.
And you see, you couldn't imagine either Edward Fox or Jeremy Irons did it as well, doing or John Gielgud.
No, Jeremy asked me to come and do it for him when he did it on the radio. He asked me to come and do all those bits.
Yes. Somehow the idea of John Gielgud playing your father and say, you know, come to read your cast meter. Sorry. Somehow John Gielgud always was John Gielgud, wasn't he?
Yes. Yes. Well, some people, I mean, there are different kind of actors. There are those who are actors on their own personality, which can be wonderful. And there are those of us who like to become something else and just, take on another skin and another. And I mean, the only thing, I am very glad that I can do very posh people.
Queen Mary.
The only link with the speakers before is that I've just played Queen Mary in The Crown, and I can play anything.
Well, you said I don't mind how playing old women. I don't mind playing hideous old women as long as I can be funny, and that you do. You're fine playing Queen Mary, and
she wasn't very funny though, was she?
No, but she was.
I didn't have much of a laugh.
But she was brilliant.
No. I don't like to do a script that doesn't have something funny in it. That's true. I like to find one funny line. There is only one place you can make the audience laugh in John Gabriel Borkman. I think we've spoken enough now. I think we've gone well past our time. It's very hard as an actor, because you're just yourself. I can't really talk about things. I'm not a lecturer. I can't. I enjoy writing this book.
It's because it's your absurd modesty that stops you from saying how good you are taking it.
I was about to say I'm not a performer. I'm only a performer if I'm in somebody else's skin.
Yes, well, you do that superbly.
I'm not a performer by myself.
But you are.
I think we've talked enough. There are jokes in the book.
Yes, there are some very funny jokes.
Not jokes. I don't like jokes.
Do you remember what Paul Newman said to you? This is when we were in the Times Off-Broadway Theatre doing Vita and Virginia with Vanessa Redgrave. And, all the stars flocked in. All Hollywood stars came to see you there. And the day that I was there, it was the last day, Paul Newman had been in. And Paul Newman had said, you'd asked Paul how his complexion was so smooth.
I don't remember this.
How did it happen? And he said, I could tell you, but you'll never do it. And it was, plunge your face every morning into a bowl of ice cubes.
Oh, yes, that's right. I've forgotten that.
But Eileen...
I wish I'd done it now.
No, that's my point. Eileen does not need to undertake any ridiculous and absurd... whatever they do with their faces, have work.
I haven't bothered, let's say that. And it served me well, because the face still moves.
Well, the face still moves, and you do have expression on your face. And you said to me, I think people with long lean faces, are like that, look like that for a reason.
I said some
yes, you did.
Things.
You said it in 1988, and it was true. You said you played Virginia like as Virginia, as, who was beautiful to those who had a fine sense of beauty, although some thought her plain. You played in a long, lean, elegant way in that part.
Well, I'm going to get up in a long, lean, elegant way now.
It makes your humour, the wit, different.
She was really witty. She was really witty.
Yes, yes.
Valerie, I think we've...
Are you going away?
Yes, I really think we've gone
well, Harry. I should have asked you to do that for me.
Thank you so much, Eileen, and thank you so much, David and Andrew. It's so wonderful to have these terrific talents, and not just having them, hearing them, but seeing them in the flesh. I think it's one of the things we've really missed the last 2 years. And it's wonderful to see you all, too, because if you weren't here, we'd be standing here on our own. And it's so wonderful to see you all and coming back, and we hope to continue these and or the oldie lunches in the future. And so I'm so grateful to our speakers and to all of you for coming today. Eileen talked about people, husbands buying the book for their wives. They can do that now, or wives can buy the book for their husbands in the cases of all three books. But you must have another drink. We've got another half an hour here, and all three of our brilliant speakers will be here to sign our book. So thank you so much for coming today. Thank you.